you tuned to Truth News Radio on the 21st of February 2015. My name's Hereward Fenton. Great pleasure to be joining you today. And we are going to cover some interesting stuff in today's one-hour show. I don't have a second hour, unfortunately, today. I don't have any great guests lined up for you, but I'm going to cover some important topics. I want to start with the David Hicks case. It's been in the news quite a bit, obviously because David Hicks's conviction for material support to terrorism was overturned in the US courts, and this is a pretty big deal. I mean, this completely changes the way, the legal reality of what happened. It's been covered in the media extensively, but what's interesting is the negativity that still surrounds David Hicks, and I want to talk a little about that. And that goes right up to the Prime Minister, who actually made a statement about it, saying he would not apologise, and he basically says that David Hicks was up to no good. So that's our Prime Minister has weighed in with a judicial opinion on David Hicks. He says David Hicks was up to no good, even though he's now been completely absolved of any guilt. Of course, there were some crimes that he allegedly committed, which were only instituted long after he had been arrested. But there's much more to that, and there's much more to understand about what the nature of those laws really was, and indeed why those laws were passed, which is not being investigated, is not being addressed by the mainstream. So that's all coming up. I want to read to you from an article that popped up on the ABC. The ABC has published a little climate change booklet in which they've attempted to dumb it all down for you and explain to you how climate change is something that's very real and something you should be very concerned about. And I just want to actually read through some of the bullet points in it and kind of reflect upon them. I mean, it's very, very dumbed down, folks, and there's just so much in it that clearly does not match up to scientific truth. And it's similar to the vaccine arguments where, media will come out with some sort of publication that is meant to sway your opinion. Quite often they publish little brochures, little glossy little brochures to explain to you why vaccines are so important. And they say things like, well, you know, vaccines cured all the major illnesses in the 20th century. And of course, it's not true. But they just put it in. They put it in bold. And you will believe it because it's put forth by the government or by a top, pharmaceutical industry or medical group, and you think, well, they wouldn't lie, would they? And that's what it always comes down to. You think, as a dumbed-down member of the public, you think that these important people with good jobs who wear nice suits and talk very well, right, you know, all the key words, all the memes that trigger you to in your tribal mentality to kind of bow down and respect them because they look like prestigious people, but they're actually telling you complete bollocks. So it's interesting. And I mean, it's so easy to illustrate some of the most egregious lies. I'm going to talk a little bit today about the Mars One mission, which, as you've probably heard, it's been on the news a fair bit, that they're planning to send a bunch of volunteers to Mars. And there's a clip that was broadcast on the Today Show interviewing one of the finalists of these volunteers who are heading to Mars. And I want to reflect a little bit on that because, well, I can tell you I have some major, major credibility issues with the whole thing. And this, of course, feeds into some of my other concerns about space travel generally, as we've talked about on this show quite a lot. But we'll cover that briefly in today's show. And one more thing we'll be looking at is I'm going to play to you a little comedy clip from John Oliver, who I believe was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart for a long time. And he has his own show, and he does these really detailed but funny exposés of issues in our society. And this particular one I want to play is about the pharmaceutical industry. And he really rips them a new one. I can tell you, it's quite interesting. He really manages to get in there and say some very important things. And the things that he says, and I'm sure he's not an anti-vaccine person. He doesn't mention vaccines at all. But everything that he says applies completely to that topic, and many, many other topics in the field of the medical industrial complex and the way in which they manipulate and control public opinion and so much of our public money, and there isn't really much alternative for us to find information. We're just sort of confronted by this giant wall of this kind of cartel of companies telling us how to keep healthy and what we have to do. And then, of course, it gets to the point now where they're wanting to bully us, more and more bully us, into taking their medicines. And it's happened with vaccines, but it's also happened with cancer treatments. Parents who've got children with leukemia can have their children removed if they don't agree to the treatments. So it's really has become more and more of a bastion of state power. So that's all coming up, folks. Now, let's begin with David Hicks. I want to play to you a little clip here from The Guardian. This is an interview that was done with David Hicks, where he talks about the case and the fact that he's now been exonerated. So we'll just play a bit of that for you right now.
So, David, how does it feel to be finally exonerated after fighting for this for over a decade?
Because the fight's been going on for so long to have my name cleared, I actually feel quite exhausted, quite tired. But it's a great relief because I feel like at last this is the end. I can now move forward with my life and leave that chapter behind.
Do you feel any anger towards the people, either the politicians or the soldiers themselves who put you through this experience?
I don't feel any anger to what was done to me. I think I'm too burnt out. I was too beaten at the time, defeated, to feel that way. I'm just tired.
Do you feel like you'll be able to get on with your life now that this has been, now that your name has been cleared?
This will help greatly being able to move forward, but there's going to be a lot of aspects from the time I spent Guantanamo that will remain with me, psychologically, physically. There's a lot of physical problems that's now getting in the way of my ability to do my day job, which is my only income, so these are issues I'm going to have to continue to deal with.
Will you be seeking an apology from the Australian government?
No, I won't be seeking an apology. I doubt that they would give one, and if they did, it wouldn't be sincere.
Do you think you'll ever be able to put what happened behind you, or will it always be a part of who you are?
I believe I've already put a lot of it behind me, and I've already tried my hardest, really, to move forward. But as I previously mentioned, there's going to be parts that will stay with me probably for the rest of my life.
How do you feel about the role of the Australian public in putting pressure on the government to find some way to free you from Guantanamo Bay?
That pressure from the public greatly helped me. It'd be easy for someone in my position to feel very cynical towards life at large, I think, but the public, those who have stood up for what they believed in, not just for an Australian citizen, but against torture, against just throwing the law to the side, gives me great hope.
I'll just pause it there. You can watch the rest of that. I'll put the link on the show notes. The torture question, of course, really is a question of crimes that were committed against David Hicks. And we really aren't hearing much talk about that in the media. I mean, he says he was tortured for 5 years. There were beatings, there were injections, there were all kinds of like drugs that were administered to him. I don't think he's actually said he was waterboarded, although he knows of a lot of other prisoners who were waterboarded. And these are clearly crimes that were committed against David Hicks. And so, you know, when Tony Abbott just says, oh, you know, I'm not going to say we're sorry and, you know, he was up to no good, it's an incredible whitewash of something that's really dark and still going on potentially. I mean, we really don't know what is currently going on with CIA renditions and all this type of stuff. Most of what they do is completely secret anyway. This topic needs to be fleshed out with an understanding of why, indeed, David Hicks was arrested. David Hicks was arrested while with the Taliban. He had been training with the Taliban, and that was in the context of a war that had been started by the West. I mean, of course, David Hicks was inducted into Islamic extremism, and I don't endorse that in any way, and I don't think he was or is a very, you know, deeply reflective, highly sort of intellectually passionate person. He's more the type of person who gets pulled in and sucked into an ideology. But let's face the reality, folks, is that Afghanistan was invaded by the United States with the assistance of Australia. And they were defending their own country. I mean, imagine if Australia was invaded, what would you do? So the fact that he was giving assistance to a country that had been invaded does not equate to being up to no good. I mean, there is no evidence that he was involved in terrorism. Like, had he been involved in terrorism, then of course he would have been convicted. I mean, had there been any evidence of that? Had he confessed to that? He didn't, because he wasn't. So it's very clear that he was not involved in terrorism. And then this material assistance to terrorism law that was passed afterwards and then applied retrospectively was an incredibly duplicitous law to try and snag people like him who were simply supporting a foreign, you know, one side in a foreign conflict. Of course, now we've got other laws that have recently been passed that actually ban you from engaging in foreign conflicts, but they're incredibly incredibly ambiguous too, because of course Australia regularly sends troops in the aid of one or other side in a foreign conflict, but that's okay because it's sanctioned by the government. We are going to break. I'll continue with this topic when we get back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's a great pleasure to be talking to you today. We'll be right back. Australia, and I'm talking a little about David Hicks, about the case, about its connections to the war in Afghanistan, and of course the big elephant in the room, which is 9/11. Now, as we were saying, David Hicks was arrested because he was supporting the Taliban, who were the government of Afghanistan, and Afghanistan had been invaded by foreigners. That's the base reality. He was not convicted for terrorism. He was not involved in terrorist attacks, right? So, you know, he's not a terrorist. But then retrospective laws were passed that that said giving material assistance to terrorist organization was a new type of crime. So you yourself, like David Hicks, might not be involved in any terrorism, might not have any intention in being involved in terrorism, but because he gives material assistance to an organization which is labeled as terrorist, he can now be convicted under a very, very harsh law. So that law itself needs to be really looked at, and it's totally a perversion of justice, because it's very easy for governments to declare such and such an organization as being a terrorist organization. And then the definition of organization is so vague. I mean, it's not as if these people have like official offices or like, you know, registered companies, right? They don't, they're not part of, you know, Al-Qaeda doesn't sort of have an entry in the phone book or, you know, a little website. And I mean, of course they have websites that pop up from time to time, as does ISIS, but you know, they're not part of the infrastructure of business or commerce or government. So it's up to a subjective opinion as to what is Al-Qaeda. And, of course, the CIA engage in that kind of subjective decision-making all the time. When they launch drone strikes in Yemen and Pakistan, they just say, well, we've identified this little group here as being part of so-called Al-Qaeda. How? Oh, well, we just know. You know, just it's our intelligence. So we're just going to kill these people. I mean, that's how it works, right? So the definition of what is Al-Qaeda is a subjective definition, and it is made in secret by people who are answerable to nobody. So David Hicks was convicted under a law which says giving material assistance to an organization which you have defined as terrorism based on purely secret subjective decisions is now criminal too. But it gets worse. Because the whole reason and justification for the US presence in Afghanistan was built on the lie of 9/11. Because we know, anyone who's looked into the basic facts of what happened on that day, of course, listens to this show, know it's one of the key themes that we've been talking about ever since we started the show, that it doesn't stand up to scrutiny. The collapse of the Twin Towers, what happened at the Pentagon, none of that can be realistically attributed to a conspiracy that began in Afghanistan and was completely contained within a group of jihadists. It's just not feasible. The buildings would not have come down from having planes flown into them in that way. A plane should never have been able to hit the Pentagon. There's so much more to it, and we can say that with great confidence without even needing to go into all the myriad of details and all the myriad of forensic evidence that demonstrates that the buildings were brought down in controlled demolitions, etc., etc. We can just stand back and look at the big picture and say, hang on, this does not add up. And you know, with any major events in history, you can do that. You can stand back and you can see what happened. I mean, you know, take the Reichstag fire in Nazi Germany. It's so clear that that was part of a pattern of the way the Nazis intended to seize power. We can't assemble the forensic evidence that proves that that Hitler gave the order to start the fire at the Reichstag so he could then create a state of emergency so that he could then pass the Enabling Act and assume total authoritarian power. We can't prove the forensic details of that, but we look back and we see the pattern of what happened. And historians do this, and historians will do this about 9/11. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind about that. But, of course, we are still in the phase where the apologists and the media and this giant mechanism of propaganda is dedicated to keeping you in the matrix, keeping you in the narrative. So, I mean, here's an article from The Australian, a typical article of a lot of the negativity that's coming forth in regard to David Hicks. This is titled, Self-Styled Jihadi David Hicks is No Innocent Abroad. The US has quashed David Hicks' confessed conviction for providing material support to terrorism. As anticipated, his lawyer and activists on the green left of politics are professing Hicks's innocence and even asking whether he might be deserving of an apology or compensation. These suggestions are a perverted distortion of reality. Hicks should count himself lucky to be alive, let alone free. He is a one-time self-declared jihadist who took up arms with militants and stood against our allies, campaigning against the US and the West. Well, you know, as I said before, he was engaged in a conflict that was started by us, okay? I mean, you know, we didn't even provide any evidence at the time, and we still don't have that evidence, by the way, but we didn't provide any evidence that the Taliban were involved in 9/11. And I mean, even people like Noam Chomsky have come forward and said that. I mean, the US didn't provide a shred of evidence to justify what they did when they went into Afghanistan. They just said, no, you're involved, and we're going to take you out. And everyone said, yeah, great, you know, because it's like, wow, the tough guys are coming. You know, it's like something out of the movies. It's like Clint Eastwood. You know, it's like, wow, they're going to take them out. They're going to smoke them out. And this utter stupidity is what prevailed. Just continuing from the article, it can only be the visceral anti-Americanism of the liberal left that seeks to lionize a man who trained with Al-Qaeda and other terror groups. He was on the battlefield in Afghanistan with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces, who at that time engaged in what was effectively a war against the West, including the US and its allies, such as Australia. Again, you know, they have to drum home the fear message, the propaganda message that we're involved in a great war, a great conflict, and that he was assisting the enemy, right? A complete nonsense, a complete furphy. Once captured, Hicks could not be processed under Afghan law or US law, nor was he technically a prisoner of war. He was an unlawful combatant on the wrong side of some messy stateless divide in the opening skirmishes of the war against terror. For Hicks, this was a conscious decision. He left Afghanistan in September 2001 and was in Pakistan when he heard the news about the 9/11 attacks in New York and Washington. Hicks then returned to Kandahar in Afghanistan and served alongside the Taliban before he was captured by the US-aligned Northern Alliance. Now, I won't read any more of that article, just make one more point. The Northern Alliance was just another tribal fiefdom in Afghanistan, and they were certainly no better than the Taliban. They committed a lot of crimes, and they had a lot of the oppression of women, a lot of the same issues. But they were, of course, lauded as being our allies, the Northern Alliance, you know, the partisans. Of course, all rubbish, all just a fake narrative designed to make you fear the Taliban, hate the Taliban, and then believe that there are some guys in Afghanistan who are on our side. But, I mean, 11 years later, 14 years later, it's quite clear that, you know, the Northern Alliance wasn't anything. Afghanistan is just descending back into the same sort of tribal mixture of what it was, and some terrible things going on there, and nothing's resolved. But some strategic goals were met, that's all. Some strategic goals of the power-crazed military-industrial complex and its oligarchy, who basically wanted to take over the world. So we're going to break. We will be back with some more really important news topics with Truth News Radio Australia. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And my name's Herewood Fenton, and I am the webmaster and host of truthnews.com.au and the radio podcast, which goes out every week via Logos Radio Network. And I would like to invite you, dear listener, to become a subscriber to this show. It's extremely easy and quick. You simply go to www.truthnews.com.au and you click on the banner that says, I want to be a subscriber. And you can be a subscriber either on a monthly basis or a yearly basis. And if you don't have the full amount, if you're financially challenged for whatever reason, and of course we won't question that, you can become a concessional subscriber, which is about $30. The full subscription is $65, but if you do the full subscription, you get the wonderful TNRA T-shirt, which is something pretty unique and worth having. So do consider that. Very important to get financial support for a show like this. Very, very difficult to indeed do it without spending a lot of money, believe me. Now, I'm going to return to another topic now, which is one of our old favourites, climate change. The Australian, one of the Australian sort of bureaucratic government-funded bodies has put out a little lovely little document. It's actually the Australian Academy of Science. Isn't that wonderful? They've got a strange logo. It looks like a flying saucer. Now, the title of the document is The Science of Climate Change, Questions and Answers. And this will allay all your concerns. Ladies and gentlemen, this will explain to you in simple language that even an autistic child can understand, because most of us are autistic these days, of course, so we do have to dumb things down. Having said that, it's all factually correct, and important men and women who wear white lab coats have signed off on this, right? So here we go. I'm just going to read to you a little bit of the intro and some of the key points. Earth's climate has changed over the past century. The atmosphere and oceans have warmed, sea levels have risen, and glaciers and ice sheets have decreased in size. The best available evidence indicates that greenhouse gas emissions from human activities are the main cause. Continuing increases in greenhouse gases will produce further warming and other changes in Earth's physical environment and ecosystems. The science behind these statements is supported by extensive studies based on four main lines of evidence. So the four lines of evidence, I'll just read out the main headings. Physical principles, the record of the distant past, measurements from the recent past, and climate models. Now, I don't really have time to read to you all the detail because it is quite long. Even though it is dumbed down, there is still has quite a lot of verbiage. But I want to focus in on some of the more egregious untruths that are in this document. For example, and they're really not hard to find. I mean, in the section titled The Record of the Distant Past, it says the Earth has gone through 10 major ice age cycles over approximately the past million years. Well, of course, that's true, and that's you know, that's accepted science. But then it says, over the last few thousand years of this period, during which civilizations developed, the climate was unusually stable. Now, that is a very clever little furphy that they have introduced in there, which, although it is factually true on one level, conveys the completely wrong impression about the last 10, 15,000 years, right? Because since the end of the Ice Age, there have been quite a lot of spikes and troughs in global temperature, and they've been quite significant. Of course, compared to the ice ages compared to that massive change, they're much more mild. But remember, when we're talking about climate change, we're talking about changes that are even much more trivial than that. So when they say that over the last few thousand years, climate was unusually stable. Yes, unusually stable compared to the like 15 degree temperature oscillations that occurred over over periods of 200,000 years. But of course, we're talking about a smaller time frame, so you're not going to get that sort of temperature change over a smaller time frame as well. I mean, there's a lot of things in that statement that are just deceptively wrong. Over the last 10,000 years, there have been some very significant temperature changes. We had the Bronze Age warming. We had then a drop-off in temperature. We had the Roman warming. These are all different phases in the last 10,000 years. So, you know, if you look at the graph of what happened since the beginning of the Holocene, which is the geological period that they give to the post-glacial period of the last 10 to 15,000 years, you had a warming, a cooling, a warming, a cooling, a warming, a cooling. You had the Bronze Age, you had the Roman, you had the medieval period, and you had the late, the 20th century warming. And the science, folks, is very clear that the late 20th century warming is no more significant than the Roman warming or the Bronze Age warming. I mean, no one ever even talks about those in climate change circles because it's so clear. They'll talk about the medieval warming because it's a little bit debatable as to whether the medieval warming was more or less significant than the late 20th century warming. But we're still talking about tiny variations compared to the big changes of the last millions of years. So it's a complete deception. Just in that one little paragraph there, they are pulling the wool over your eyes, and this is absolutely rock solid what I'm saying. I mean, you can take this to the bank, right? This is not just a debate about one person's research, one person's evidence versus another person's evidence. This is a deceptive rendering of information which we can all agree on because it's all the acknowledged historical scientific paleontological record, right? They're just misrepresenting it. Okay, let's just go to the next section here. Measurements from the recent past. This is now the last 150 years. We're talking about a tiny fraction even of that 10,000 year period. We're talking about a tenth of that period, and they're now talking about that the Earth's surface has warmed in that period. And this is very interesting because they say the last 150 years, but the IPCC, in all of their wisdom and with all of their knowledge, have stated in their official documents that man-made climate change did not kick in until the mid-20th century. That human activity was not a significant impact on climate before then. But in this nauseating, offensive piece of advertising here that they've put forth, they're basically claiming the whole last 150 years as part of their evidence. And of course, it has warmed over the last 150 years. We've been coming out of a cooling period that had its bottom of the trough of the graph, if you were to look at it as a temperature graph, around about the year 1800 or 1750 to 1800. In that period of time, it became much cooler, and then it's been warming ever since. But human impact was negligible at that point. So anyway, I'll leave that with you. I've got some other things to cover in the next section, but have a look at this document, and I'm sure you can find dozens more furfies in it like that. It's just advertising. As we know, advertising is basically lies to sell you things. We're coming right back.
Happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? And at that point...
Hi, welcome back, folks. You're with Truth News Radio. And I've been running through some stories today, covering a few topics. I want to move on to the subject of the Mars One mission. And I want to play to you a little from an interview that was held on the Today Show. I just want to sort of reflect on the type of... the mentality behind this idea of sending a group of volunteers who appear to have no particular skills, and they don't have any great talents or professions. They're not trained astronauts, and we're just going to stick them in spaceships and send them off to Mars, and we're going to have a reality TV show where we watch them. I mean, that's literally the way this thing is being pitched. Let me just play to you a little of the clip here from the interview on the Today Show.
It takes you back, doesn't it, Lisa?
A bit of Ziggy Stardust there, Carlos. Uh-huh.
What if you were offered the chance to make history by becoming one of the first people to live the rest of your days on Mars? Would you do it, eh? If it meant a one-way ticket, though.
That's a concept right there. Well, Brisbane mum and teacher Natalie Lawler has just been named as one of the 100 global finalists for this four-person team that will head off on the first mission to live on the red planet. And Natalie joins us now. Good morning to you, Natalie. We're still trying to get our heads around this. What makes you want to go and live on the red planet?
Oh, there's lots of reasons why I want to go. I think that... all humans have this natural curiosity, and it's the next giant leap for mankind.
I guess we have all sorts of exotic ideals about what might be on Mars, but that's the reality there. It's a bit like being out in the desert somewhere, isn't it? What is your ideal about Mars?
Well, I think that the 7 months in transit to get to Mars is going to be quite horrific. Mm. I am not looking forward to that part of the mission. But showing the world that we can live sustainably. The first hole that we dig, we expect to find more about Mars than we have with rovers being on the planet for the last few decades. So there's the science and the sustainable living. If we can live on Mars, we can live anywhere.
So you're one of 100. It'll finally be four people who will go. Is Dexter going to do a compatibility score on how well you all going to live together? Because what happens if you don't like those three people?
Yes, Dr. Norbert Kraft, who's in charge of the application process, has lots of experience in selecting astronauts, and he will profile us and put us in teams that we train for 8 years with, so we'll know our team very well.
All right, I'll just leave it there. Great. A scientist is going to profile them and make sure that they're all compatible. And they're just going to be stuck in a spaceship, and they're going to go for 7 months on this trip that no human or even animal or any life form has ever done before. In fact, we've never sent anyone out of low space orbit since the Apollo missions. Cough, cough. I mean, folks, there's something completely off about this. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what the truth of it is. I don't know why they're doing it, but it's not real. There is no way this is real. And the quality or the intellectual quality there of the lady who was being interviewed is obviously not particularly high grade. I mean, I'm going to be really bored on the trip over. I don't know what I'm going to do. It's going to be so boring. I'll tell you what, love, you're going to be pretty bored when you get to Mars as well. It's not going to be much better when you get there. I mean, at least when you're on the way, you'll be able to look out the window. Presuming they put little portholes in there, like they did for the astronauts who went to the moon. You'll be able to look out there and look at the stars and maybe take some photos and send them back to us. But, when you're on Mars, it's just going to be a pink sky, and you're just going to be sitting inside your little bubble. And, of course, the low gravity there is going to mean you're going to be bouncing around all over the place, and your bones are going to all atrophy because, you need gravity your body needs Earth gravity, right? You're going to have massive problems very quickly with your health. You're probably going to only live, who knows? I mean, we've never done it before. I mean, we've had astronauts in space for a few months at a time living in zero gravity, and they have to do a lot of work to reintegrate back into Earth when they come back down. But, I mean, Mars is like, I think it's less than a third of Earth gravity. So it's going to have a massive effect on your body being there. And of course, you wouldn't be able to come back. Imagine if you stayed there for a year, your body would never be able to readjust back to Earth gravity. Anyway, look, the whole thing is very perplexing and very odd. I will continue to monitor this, and maybe someday we'll we'll have some understanding of what this is. What I would say is that this is going to pan out indefinitely into the future as something just to continually fill in little puff pieces for television. And no one will really care that it just keeps getting delayed and delayed and delayed ad infinitum. Now, folks, I've got one more thing to play for you today, and we don't really have a lot of time, but I want to play a little from this comedy clip with John Oliver, because it really highlights so many of the things about the medical industrial complex. And we've only got a few minutes left in the hour, but I'll just play to you a little of this, and you can get the flavour of it, and perhaps you can play it at your leisure. Here we go.
Prescription drugs, the only ovals that can bring people in the Seattle area joy anymore. To put it mildly, America takes a lot of these things.
70% of Americans take at least one prescription drug. More than half of us take two. Researchers say a record 4 billion prescriptions were written in 2011.
Total drug spending jumped last year by 3% to nearly $330 billion with a B.
Wow. That works out to $1,000 per person on prescription drugs. Kind of makes you feel like Walter White could have made more money cooking up rheumatoid arthritis medication. But should this really be that surprising? Because it's impossible to escape pharmaceutical ads. You can't turn on the TV without being subjected to an endless stream of sleep-inducing moths, old men getting boners while varnishing chairs, or this.
If your bladder is calling the shots, you may have a medical condition called overactive bladder, or OAB.
Again? But we just went.
Okay. Listen, what that woman really needs is a pill to stop her hallucinating anthropomorphic bladders. You're locked inside a prison of your own mind, Susan! Be gone, demon bladder, be gone! That's only one small part of pharmaceutical marketing. You see, drugs aren't like most other products because you need someone's permission to buy them, which is why all drug ads end with the same catchy phrase.
Ask your doctor if Lunesta is right for you.
Ask your doctor about Mirbetric.
Ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor. Three words you're either hearing in a commercial or saying to your co-worker when he asks you if the mole on his back looks cancerous. I don't know, Gene. Ask your doctor. All I said was, how was your weekend? It's probably fine. Drug companies know that doctors hold all the real power in the prescription drug business, which is why, while they spend nearly $4 billion a year marketing directly to us, they spend an estimated $24 billion a year marketing directly to doctors. In fact, one analysis claimed that in 2013, 9 out of the top 10 drug makers spent more on marketing than they did on research. Drug companies are a bit like high school boyfriends. They're much more concerned with getting inside you than being effective once they're in there. So, we thought... Okay, don't think about that too much. We thought we'd take a look at how all that marketing money gets spent, which turns out to be surprisingly difficult. It's a pretty secretive world. You usually only get tantalising glimpses into during lawsuits years after the fact. For instance, in 2012, the government settled a case with the makers of asthma medication Advair over allegedly irresponsible marketing practices, which meant for the first time we were able to see this video of a 2001 Advair sales meeting.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Daryl Baker, Simon Jones, Rob Yott, and Ken Timer.
Y'all ready for this?
What the f***? That was for an asthma medication, and they were treating it like an NBA pregame show. Please welcome, he's 59, white, he likes turkey sandwiches, and his wife's name is Karen. Ladies and gentlemen, say hello to Daryl Boom Boom Baker! The audience in that room were pharmaceutical reps, the foot soldiers in every company's drug marketing efforts. Now, drug companies will tell you their reps are there to educate doctors, but behind closed doors, that message can be a little different.
There are people in this room who are going to make an ungodly sum of money selling Advair. And you know who you are.
Ungodly? That would barely be an appropriate tone if they were trying to get cereal into people's bodies, let alone drugs.
All right, I'll just leave it there. I mean, some of the information in this is actually quite extraordinary. I mean, the number of percentage of people on prescription medicines, 70%. I mean, that's incredibly high. But, of course, most people don't think anything about it. They just think, well, it's probably normal. They just think it's probably correct that most people would be on a prescription medicine. But I can tell you it's not normal or right. I'm not on any prescription medicines, never have been, and I'm not young. I mean, look, there's a lot of people who are just living healthy lives, taking care of themselves, who will not ever need to be on prescription medicines. But people who are in the habit of just taking advice from the doctor or going to the doctor every time they have some little problem or even just going to the chemist every time they have a cough or they feel a bit fluey or whatever, they go to the chemist and they just buy whatever the person behind the counter says is the latest thing, which will be some fairly heavy, you know, hardcore medicine, even though it's not a prescription medicine. You'll get into the pattern of buying this stuff and you'll become more and more dependent on it. Partly it's psychological, partly you just need to walk into a pharmacy and you see all those medicines and you feel better already. And again, this is all part of marketing, because it is actually marketing what they're doing. And that sales meeting there, that was just incredible. So I'll put the link to that on the show notes. That is our show for this week. I will be back next week. And till then, I hope you have a great week. And do get back to me with any thoughts and ideas you had on the show. It's always good to hear from listeners. That's us for this week.